friends. Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I can't believe it. The holiday shopping season has begun. I survived Black Friday because I'm a pro. Over the long years, my daughter Haley and I have designed and perfected our early morning at the mall tradition. Arriving before 7 a.m. is not recommended for the faint of heart. Hey, the early shopper gets the parking spot. But never fear, you don't have to fight for a mall parking spot. I've got some amazing holiday stocking stuffers, fabulous titles for everyone on your list. Santa's Little Helper? Yes, that's me, and I'm happy to help. So let's turn right now to page one of the book report.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Beautiful Mystery is number 8 in the wonderful Inspector Gamache series by Louise Penny. This title is already climbing its way up the bestseller list, and it will make a welcome gift for mystery lovers. Outsiders are never admitted to the Monastery of Saint-Gilbert, hidden deep in the Quebec wilderness. 24 cloistered monks live there in prayer and peace. They grow vegetables, tend chickens, make chocolate. And they sing. Ironically, for a community that has taken a vow of silence, the monks have become world famous for their glorious voices. Their ancient chants have such a profound effect on listeners, they are called the Beautiful Mystery. But when the renowned choir director is murdered, the lock on the monastery's massive wooden door is opened to admit Chief Inspector Armand Gamache and Jean-Guy Beauvoir of the Sûreté du Québec. There they discover disquiet beneath the silence, discord in the apparent harmony. As the peace of the monastery crumbles, Gamache is forced to confront his own demons. Before finding the killer, the chief must first consider the divine, the human, and the cracks in between. Ralph Cosham narrates.
How to write music? How could he possibly communicate something that sublime? He tried writing out instructions, but that was far too cumbersome. Words alone could never describe how this music transcended the normal human state and lifted man to the divine. The monk was stumped. For days and weeks he went about his monastic life, joining the others in prayer and work and prayer, chanting the offices, teaching the young and easily distracted novices. And then one day he noticed that they focused on his right hand as he guided their voices. Up, down, faster, slower, quietly, quietly. They'd memorized the words, but depended upon his hand signals for the music itself. That night, after Vespers, this nameless monk sat by precious candlelight, staring at the psalms written so carefully on the vellum. Then he dipped his quill in ink and drew the very first musical note. It was a wave above a word, a single, short, squiggly line. Then another, and another. He drew his hand, stylized, guiding some unseen monk to raise his voice, higher, then holding, then higher again, hanging there for just a moment, then swooping and sweeping downward in a giddy musical descent. He hummed as he wrote. His simple hand signals on the page fluttered so that the words came alive and lifted off, became airborne, joyous. He heard the voices of the monks not yet born joining him, singing exactly the same chants that freed him and lifted his heart to heaven. In trying to capture the beautiful mystery, this monk had invented written music. Not yet notes. What he'd written became known as neumes. Over the centuries, this plain chant evolved into complex chant. Instruments were added, harmonies were added, which led to chords and staffs, and finally musical notes, do, re, mi. Modern music was born. The Beatles, Mozart, rap, disco, Annie Get Your Gun, Lady Gaga. All sprang from the same ancient seed. A monk, drawing his hand, humming and conducting and straining for the divine. Gregorian chant was the father of Western music, but it was eventually killed by its ungrateful children, buried, lost and forgotten. Until the early 1800s, when Dom Prosper, sickened by what he saw as the vulgarity of the church and the loss of simplicity and purity, decided it was time to resurrect the original Gregorian chants, to find the voice of God. His monks fanned out across Europe. They searched monasteries and libraries and collections, with one goal, to find that original ancient manuscript. The monks came back with many treasures lost in remote libraries and collections. And finally, Dom Prosper decided one book of plain song, written in faded neumes, was the original. The first, and perhaps only, written record of what Gregorian chant would have sounded like. It was on a piece of lambskin almost 1,000 years old. Rome disagreed. The Pope had conducted his own search and found another written record. He insisted his piece of tattered vellum recorded how the divine office should be sung. And so, as often happens when men of God disagree, a war erupted. Volleys of plain song were hurled between the Benedictine Monastery of Solem and the Vatican, each insisting theirs was closer to the original and therefore closer to the divine. Academics, musicologists, famous composers and humble monks weighed in on the subject, choosing sides in the escalating battle that soon became more about power and influence and less about simple voices raised to the glory of God. Who had found the original Gregorian chant? How should the divine office be sung? Who possessed the voice of God? Who was right? Finally, after years, a quiet consensus arose among the academics, and then was even more quietly suppressed. Neither was correct. While the monks of Solem were almost certainly far closer to the truth than Rome, it appeared even they were not there yet. What they found was historic, priceless, but it was incomplete.
We have just heard The Beautiful Mystery by Louise Penny. For friends or family who prefer nonfiction, may I suggest Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie. His descent into hell began on February 14, 1989, when Rushdie was telephoned by a BBC journalist with the news he had just been sentenced to death by the Ayatollah Khomeini. His crime? Authorship of the Satanic Verses, a novel accused of being anti-Islam, the Prophet, and the Quran. So begins the extraordinary story of how a writer was forced underground to save his life. Why the title of the book? Asked by his police team to choose an alias, Rushdie thought of the writers he loved, Conrad and Chekhov. For his new name, he combined their first names, Joseph and Anton. The book chronicles Rushdie's life during this 9-year period. How he lived with police protection, struggled for support and understanding from governments, intelligence operators, publishers, journalists, and fellow writers, and finally, how he regained his freedom. The author and Sam Daster share the narration.
With every stroke she shed a tear. Risselty, rosselty, hey, bombosity, nickety, nackety, retroquality, willoughby, wallaby, mo, mo, mo. There are 4 blackbirds on the climbing frame. And then a 5th arrives. Inside the school, the children are singing. Now there are hundreds of blackbirds on the climbing frame, and thousands more birds fill the sky, like a plague of Egypt. A song has begun, to which there is no end. When the first blackbird comes down to roost on the climbing frame, it seems individual, particular, specific. it is not necessary to deduce a general theory, a wider scheme of things, from its presence. Later, after the plague begins, it's easy for people to see the first blackbird as a harbinger. But when it lands on the climbing frame, it's just one bird. In the years to come, he will dream about this scene, understanding that his story is a sort of prologue, the tale of the moment when the first blackbird lands. When it begins, it's just about him. It's individual, particular, specific. Nobody feels inclined to draw any conclusions from it. It will be a dozen years and more before the story grows until it fills the sky, like the Archangel Gabriel standing on the horizon, like a pair of planes flying into tall buildings, like the plague of murderous birds in Alfred Hitchcock's great film. At the CBS offices, he was the big news story of the day. People in the newsroom and on various monitors were already using the word that would soon be hung around his neck like a millstone. They used the word as if it were a synonym for death sentence, and he wanted to argue pedantically that that was not what the word meant. But from this day forward, it would mean that for most people in the world, and for him. Fatwa. I inform the proud Muslim people of the world that the author of the Satanic Verses book, which is against Islam, the Prophet, and the Quran, and all those involved in its publication who were aware of its content, are sentenced to death. I ask all the Muslims to execute them wherever they find them. Somebody gave him a printout of the text as he was escorted towards the studio for his interview. Again, his old self wanted to argue, this time with the word sentence. This was not a sentence handed down by any court he recognized, or which had any jurisdiction over him. It was the edict of a cruel and dying old man. But he also knew that his old self's habits were of no use anymore. He was a new self now. He was the person in the eye of the storm. No longer the Salman his friends knew, but the Rushdie who was the author of Satanic Verses, a title subtly distorted by the omission of the initial "the." The Satanic Verses was a novel. Satanic Verses were verses that were satanic, and he was their satanic author, Satan Rushdie, the horned creature on the placards carried by demonstrators down the streets of a faraway city, the hanged man with protruding red tongue in the crude cartoons they bore. Hang Satan Rushdie. How easy it was to erase a man's past and to construct a new version of him, an overwhelming version, against which it seemed impossible to fight. King Charles I had denied the legitimacy of the sentence handed down against him. That hadn't stopped Oliver Cromwell from having him beheaded. He was no king. He was the author of a book. He looked at the journalists looking at him, and he wondered if this was how people looked at men being taken to the gallows, or the electric chair, or the guillotine. One foreign correspondent came up to be friendly. He asked this man what he should think about what Khomeini had said. How seriously should he take it? Was it just a rhetorical flourish, or something genuinely dangerous? "Oh, don't worry too much," the journalist said. "Khomeini sentences the President of the United States to death every Friday afternoon." On air, when he was asked how he responded to the threat, he said, "I wish I'd written a more critical book." He was proud, then and always, that he had said this. It was the truth. He did not feel his book was especially critical of Islam. But as he said on American television that morning, a religion whose leaders behaved in this way could probably do with a little criticism.
We've just heard a sampling of Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Here's a title foodies will adore. Marcus Samuelson was only 3 when he, his mother, and his sister, all battling tuberculosis, walked 75 miles to a hospital in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. Tragically, his mother succumbed to the disease, but Marcus and his sister recovered. 1 year later, they were welcomed into a loving middle-class family in Gothenburg, Sweden. It was there that Marcus's new grandmother, Helga, sparked in him a lifelong passion for food and cooking. Yes Chef chronicles Marcus's remarkable journey from Helga's humble kitchen to some of the most demanding restaurants in Switzerland and France. From his grueling stints on cruise ships to his arrival in New York City, where his talent and ambition came together at Aquavit, earning him a coveted 3-star rating at age 24. But Samuelson's career of chasing flavors, as he calls it, had only just begun. In the years that followed, there have been White House dinners, crises, and most importantly, the opening of his beloved Red Rooster in Harlem. At Red Rooster, Samuelson has fulfilled a dream of creating a truly diverse, multiracial dining room, a place where presidents and prime ministers rub elbows with jazz musicians, aspiring artists, bus drivers, and nurses. It's a place where an orphan from Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, living in America, can feel at home. To quote Bill Clinton, the Red Rooster's arrival in Harlem brought with it a chef who has reinvigorated and reimagined what it means to be American. In his famed dishes, and now in this memoir, Marcus Samuelson tells a story that reaches past racial and national divides to the foundations of family, hope, and downright good food, unquote. The author narrates,
I've never seen a picture of my mother. I've traveled to her homeland, my homeland, dozens of times. I met her brothers and sisters. I found my birth father and 8 half-brothers and sisters I didn't know I had. I met my mother's relatives in Ethiopia. When I asked them to describe my mother, they throw out generalities like, she was nice, they tell me. She was pretty. She was smart. Nice, pretty, smart. The words seem meaningless, except the last is a clue, because even today, in rural Ethiopia, girls are not encouraged to go to school. That my mother was intelligent rings true, because I know she had to be shrewd to save the lives of myself and my sister, which is what she did, in the most mysterious and miraculous of ways. My mother's family never owned a photograph of her, which tells you everything you need to know about where I'm from and what the world was like for the people who gave me life. In 1972 in the United States, Polaroid introduced its most popular instant camera. In 1972, the year my mother died, an Ethiopian woman could go her whole life without having her picture taken, especially if, as was the case with my mother, her life was not long. I've never seen a picture of my mother, but I know how she cooked. For me, my mother is berbere, an Ethiopian spice mixture. You use it on everything from lamb to chicken to roasted peanuts. It's our salt and pepper. I know she cooked with it because it's in the DNA of every Ethiopian mother. Right now, if I could, I would lead you to the red tin in my kitchen, one of dozens I keep by my stove in my apartment in Harlem, filled with my own blend marked with blue electrical tape and my own illegible scrawl. I would reach into this tin and grab a handful of red orange powder and hold it up to your nose so you could smell the garlic, the ginger, the sun-dried chili. My mother didn't have a lot of money, so she fed us shiro. It's a chickpea flour you boil, kind of like polenta. You pour into hot water and add butter, onions, and pepper. You simmer it for about 45 minutes until it's consistency of hummus, and then you eat it with injera, a sour, rich bread made from the grain called teff. I know this is what she fed us, because this is what poor people in Ethiopia eat. My mother carried the chickpea powder in her pocket or bag. That way, all she needed to make dinner was water and fire. Injera is also portable, so it's never wasted. If you don't finish it, you leave it outside, let it dry in the sun, then you eat it like chips. In Mekki, the small farming village where I'm from, there are no roads. We're actually from even a smaller village than Mekki, called Abragodana. That doesn't exist on most maps. You go to Mekki, you take a right in the middle of nowhere, walk about 5 miles, and that is where we're from. I know my mother was not taller than 5 feet, 2 inches, but I also know she was not delicate. Those country women in Ethiopia are strong because they walk everywhere. I know her body because I know those women. When I go there now, I stare at the young mothers to the point of being impolite. I stare at those young women and their children, and it's like watching a home movie that does not exist on my childhood. Each woman has a kid who might well be me on her back. The fingers of her right hand are interlocked with another slightly older kid, and that kid is like my sister. The woman has her food and wears in her bag, which is slung across her chest and rests on her hip. The older kid is holding a bucket of water on her shoulders, a bucket that's almost as heavy as she is. That's how strong that child is.
We've just heard Yes, Chef by Marcus Samuelson. Thrilled to introduce Chef Norman Van Aken, the founding father of New World Cuisine. Norman is credited with introducing fusion into the lexicon of modern cookery. He is the only Floridian inducted into James Beard's Who's Who of Food and Beverage in America. He shared his gospel of the cuisines of the sun on the Today Show, Good Morning America, CNN, The Food Network, and more. Today, we'll be speaking with him about his 6th cookbook written with his son, Justin, My Key West Kitchen. Mario Batali describes the book as a brilliant tour of one of the most special places in America, the intersection of the South and the Islands. Welcome, Norman. Thanks so much for stopping by the book report.
My pleasure, Elaine.
I loved your description of Key West, the magical little scrap of land at the end of the rainbow. When and how did you first come to Key West?
Well, believe it or not, it was the end of winter, basically, in 1971, and I hitchhiked to a party in Champaign, Urbana, some friends were having, and toward the end of that party, some friends said, well, where's Steve? And we were like, I don't know, who knows? Oh, Steve, he's down in Key West. Key West, is that the last one all the way down there at the end of Florida? Yeah, that's where it is. Well, let's go see him. With that, we jumped into a van, and we drove 36 hours to Key West. So we were pretty young and crazy, but it was love at first sight, and it's a love affair that is like a love affair with your wife, with, you know, the woman or person you love for, you know, for all the years you're an adult, and that's the way it's been for Key West.
Your book, My Key West Kitchen, has an introduction to each recipe. It's kind of like a culinary travelogue of Key West in its glory. Some say that the key today is very changed. What's your opinion?
Well, I think that the overall perception to the tourist and the outsider is that Key West has changed a lot and become much more of a Mardi Gras, Bourbon Street kind of a place. But it really hasn't. And for those of us that have known it all these years, we know how to escape that kind of nonsense and get to the essence and the back roads and the back parts of Key West. And Justin, who is my co-author, as well as my son, who was born there, and I unravel that for the people who have a copy of Key West Kitchen. And we bring them to this place that is, I think, equal to the place that we fell in love with. You just have to have the guide that we provide them.
Yeah, well, the book is divided into Key West neighborhoods.
It's a wonderful idea. What was your inspiration for that?
Well, that credit has to go for Justin. We were, you know, kind of approaching the book from a conventional standpoint of soups, salads, appetizers, and entrees. And he goes, Dad, you know what? This is about Key West. It's not about just cooking. Let's look at this the way we live in Key West. And we live in it in a sense the way that you live almost anywhere, which is you experience Miami by neighborhoods. You experience wherever you live by neighborhoods in a way. And you have different neighborhoods for different things. And so that was the inspiration was, well, what about, you know, places in, on the water? What about the places in the neighborhood? What about the Bahama Village area of town? And so with that, we take people around and we have the dishes organized by the area of town that each major chapter is in.
Hmm. Well, in 1985, you were named executive chef of Louis' Backyard. What was the cuisine of Key West like in those days?
I would say it was in transformation in a way. I began cooking in Key West in 73, and what was there then was pretty much straight-ahead Cuban, Bahamian, Haitian, Old South kind of neighborhood places. There were a few grand places that came along, but really a little bit later, like the Pier House. By the time I got to Louis, Key West was experiencing the first major wave of success that it had known since the 1910 and 20, when before it went broke. And so it was a time of an awareness of the new American cuisine when I was at Louis' Backyard, and I was at Louis and doing a lot of food that would have been considered broadly American at first, and then I switched gears, living in Key West and having a really transformational moment that I describe in the book, watching a sailboat sailing past Louis' Backyard, and I began to much more restrict my sights to Florida in general and specifically South Florida.
Hmm. And can you give us a state of the union of Key West's current culinary scene?
Well, I think just as much as ever, it's a polyglot scene. It is very much... we felt like we had to overcome some of the stereotypes that were going on and let people know that if they get off, they get off into the neighborhoods and they get, you know, away from the places that have huge marketing dollars, there is still a lot to be found that is wonderful about the island and a great reason to go down to Key West and stay in the bed and breakfast and the little inns and go fishing and go biking through the neighborhoods and find the places that Justin and I still go to. And Justin lives in Key West year-round. I go down there and visit now that I have a brand-new granddaughter.
Hmm. So many of your recipes are peppered with tales of Key West characters. Can you share a favorite story?
Wow. I guess one of the first ones was the first place I worked in Key West, which was the Midget. It was the chef of the place. He was not really a chef in the conventional sense. He was a guy that cooked in the Navy. He was an African-American gentleman named Sammy, and he was known around town as Bicycle Sammy. And Sammy was if you could think of a really lean version of Louis Armstrong, he was like that. And he taught me a lot about cooking without being, let's say, his favorite thing to do. I was, you know, a dumb kid with long hair, and he was the old sage, and yet somehow his lessons came through, and he taught me this arcane language of the American diners of the 1940s and 50s, like Ike and Mike were salt and pepper, and Yum Yum was sugar, and Shipwreck was scrambled eggs, and so we take people back to that time a little bit, and we ultimately and finally do a dish that is based upon the barbecue that we made at the Midget, and Sammy makes a pot of chili, but with barbecued pork, and that's a recipe that we kind of got the inclinations from Sammy and then took in our own direction.
Hmm. In addition to the lovely photography of the recipes, the book is filled with amazing shots of Key West and historical shots. It's a beautiful collection. Talk about the photography in the book for a moment.
We are so lucky to have been part of a team that included photographer Penny De Los Santos. I unconsciously was in love with her work before I knew her name through the pages of Savour magazine. When our editor, project manager, Anya Schmidt, sent us three different links to different photographers, I was in love with the first one, then I was in love with the second one, and then Penny came along and she stole my heart forever. And her eye and her passion is something that leaps off the pages. It's very natural. There's nothing like, you know, there's not the pictures of food. I think they look just delicious, and they look like, boy, I could make those things myself at home. And the pictures of Key West, almost as if she'd lived there her entire life as well.
Is food tied to the national mood? For example, in a downturn economy, does comfort food move to the top of the menus?
Absolutely. I think there's always time for comfort food, but I think it's when the chips are down that becomes more necessary than ever. And we're going to be in a tough economy, I think, for a while yet, no matter what happens politically. I think it's just the nature of the what happened after massive amounts of consumerism. And, you know, I think a lot of things are getting better in the sense that we probably realize that we need less than we did before, and the essentials come true. And so home, family, cooking at home, those are things that remain important. And so those are the things that we are glad to share with My Key West Kitchen.
Readers, I want to tell you My Key West Kitchen is not only a fabulous cookbook, but you should take it with you as you wander the streets of Key West. Norman, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. That was a great last sentence. I loved it.
All righty. Bye now.
Bye.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Here's an idea for sports lovers and dads alike. A Father First by Dwayne Wade, 8-time All-Star for the Miami Heat. In 2006, his third season in the NBA, Dwayne was named the Finals MVP and led Miami to the championship title. In 2012, as co-captain, he helped the Heat to their recent NBA championship. As incredible as these achievements are, it's off the court where Dwayne has sought his most cherished goal, being a good dad to his sons, Zaire and Zion. In March 2011, after a long, bitter custody battle, Dwayne was awarded sole custody of his sons in a virtually unprecedented court decision. As the son of divorced parents himself, Dwayne's early years were spent on Chicago's South Side. With poverty, violence, and drugs consuming the streets, and their mom descending into addiction, Dwayne and his sister went to live with their father. In fact, Dwayne Sr. was Dwayne's first basketball coach. This laid the groundwork for Dwayne's later mission for fathers to take greater responsibility for their children. In A Father First, we meet the coaches, mentors, and teammates who played pivotal roles in Dwayne's stunning basketball career. From his early days shooting hoops on neighborhood courts in Chicago, to rising stardom at Milwaukee's Marquette University, to his stardom with the Miami Heat and with his sons. Prentice Onayami performs the book.
When the fans are with you, their voices come together in a big booming rush of sound that you can actually feel in your body, almost like a wave that lifts you and carries you past your limits. I love the chants, the stomping of feet, the eruptions of cheers, hoots, and hollers. Besides the fact that I'm lucky to do what I love for my living, I'm blessed every day on the job with the joy of hearing fans and announcers call my name. Not to mention the various nicknames, from D-Wade to Flash to just Number 3. But as much as I love the music of the crowd when they're with me, none of that comes close to the thrill of hearing my sons call out my most favorite name of all, Daddy. Anytime, anywhere, any day. So needless to say, on the evening of Friday, March 11th, when I opened the door to greet Tregill and the boys, hearing their chorus of Daddy, Daddy, it's enough to bring on another batch of tears. Zaire bounds in first, no surprise there. But Zion somehow edges his brother out and takes a running leap into my arms for the first hug. Swinging him up on one side of me, I lift up Zaire in my other arm. Yeah, I'm strong. Then, spotting Davian, nicknamed Dada, shyly standing off to the side, I gesture for him to come on over to get in on the action. Group hug. This is crazy. This is pure happiness. Tregill, fighting her tears, joins in along with Gabrielle and some of our friends who've been helping out for most of the afternoon, arranging appointments at schools, shopping for extra clothes and school supplies, measuring for bunk beds, and making sure the kitchen's stocked with more than a weekend's worth of kid-friendly food. My mantra all day to everyone has been that we need to establish a set routine that gives them a sense of normalcy and security. Routine, I've learned, is key. Meanwhile, we're all also trying to be restrained, not wanting the boys to suspect something dramatic is up. That conversation needs to happen, but not yet. Let me look at you three. Come on now. We break out of our hug so I can admire each one of the boys, rubbing on their heads, giving each a compliment, and then more hugs. Can't help myself. In the parenting school I come from, love and praise are fundamentals, as basic as the air we breathe. Love comes first, second, and last, always. I start with my nephew Davian, whose father hasn't been on the scene regularly in his life. Same age as Zaire, Dada's an old soul, sensitive but also fun-loving. After his mom, my sister Deanna, gave her okay for him to start traveling with his cousins to visit me, Dada quickly became a steadying force for them, and for me. During the worst challenges of the custody battle, when my visitations with the boys were so infrequent and my relationship with Zaire was strained as a result, I'd invite Dada to come for a visit too, and he always made Zaire feel more comfortable and able to enjoy the fun. Dada and I high-five and low-five as I tell him how much I appreciate his help. So proud of himself, he struts off, then stops to show me one of the latest dance moves from Chicago. Zaire, never one to stand still, waits excitedly to confirm that everybody's going to the Heat game the next day. When I assure him that the game is early enough for the three boys to attend, he does a couple of dance moves he's learned from Dada to show his pride. Everyone cracks up. Not a shy kid whatsoever, Zaire has that ability to let his spirit lift the spirit of others. In fact, before I can say much more, he starts making small talk with the other adults in the room, like a seasoned conversationalist. He throws in comments on everything, from the latest YouTube music video he's seen to traffic on Biscayne Boulevard. And he's hip, too, coming up with his cool little catchphrases to respond to the adults, saying, Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Zaire, I start to laugh. You don't know nothing about that. You just making comments like you know. I hug him again, amused. He shrugs, enjoying my admiration, full of his 9-year-old swagger. I swear, if I could live my childhood over, I wouldn't mind being Zaire Wade at his age. He's an all-around cool kid, with a lot of personality, excellent athletic skills, and a real gift of gab, all on top of being very handsome.
That was A Father First by Dwayne Wade. And of course, on every good list, there are the contrarians. For them, the book report recommends Hitch 22 by political intellect Christopher Hitchens. Over the course of his 60 years, Christopher Hitchens had been a citizen of both the U.S. and the U.K. He'd been both a socialist opposed to the war in Vietnam and a supporter of the U.S. war against Islamic extremism in Iraq. He'd been both a foreign correspondent in some of the world's most dangerous places and a legendary bon vivant with an unquenchable thirst for alcohol and literature. Hitchens, who performs the book, was a fervent atheist raised as a Christian by a mother whose Jewish heritage was not revealed to him until her suicide. To Christopher Hitchens, the personal was the political. This title will be welcomed by those who sorely miss his columns and his musings, or those who'd enjoy an introduction to one of our time's most unique minds.
As I write, in the dying months of the year 2008, having just received this reminder note from the future, that future still contains the opening of the exhibition and the publication of this memoir. But the exhibition and its catalogue references also exemplify still vital elements of my past. And now, rather abruptly, between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow. T.S. Eliot's Hollow Men do not constitute my cohort, or so I hope, even though one might sometimes wish to be among the Stoics who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom. The fact is that all attempts to imagine one's own extinction are futile by definition. One can only picture the banal aspects of this event, not in my case the mourners at the funeral, again excluded by the very rules of the game itself, but the steady thunk of emails into my inbox on the day of my demise and the way in which my terrestrial mailbox will also become congested, until somebody does something to arrest the robotic electronic stupidity, or until failure to pay up leads to an abrupt cancellation of the bills and checks and solicitations, none of them ever in my lifetime arriving in the right proportions on the right day. May it be that I gain a lifetime subscription to Face to Face, and that this goes on forever, or do I mean to say for all eternity? The director of the National Portrait Gallery, the excellent Sandy Nairn, has written me an anguished letter in which he not only apologizes for having me killed off, but tries to offer both explanation and restitution. The display, he writes, also includes a photograph of Pat Kavanagh with Kingsley Amis. A last-minute change was made to the text, and instead of it reading, "The late Pat Kavanagh," it refers to yourself. This kindly meant missive makes things more poignant and more eerie rather than less. I have just opened a letter from Pat Kavanagh's husband, Julian Barnes, in which he thanks me for my note of condolence on her sudden death from cancer of the brain. I had also congratulated him on the vast critical success of his recent meditation on death, sardonically titled Nothing to be Frightened Of, which constituted an extended reflection on that undiscovered country. In my letter to Julian, I praised his balance of contrast between Lucretius, who said that since you won't know you're dead, you need not fear the condition of death, and Philip Larkin, who observes in his imperishable O Bard that this is exactly the thing about the post-mortem condition that actually does and must make one afraid. The sure extinction that we travel to, and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere. And soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true, and specious stuff that says no rational being can fear a thing it will not feel, not seeing that this is what we fear. So, it is at once a small thing and a big thing that I should have earned those transposed words, "the late," which had belonged editorially to Julian's adored wife and then became accidentally adhered to myself. When I first formed the idea of writing some memoirs, I had the customary reservations about the whole conception being perhaps too soon. Nothing dissolves this fusion of false modesty and natural reticence more swiftly than the blunt realization that the project could become, at any moment, ruled out of the question as having been undertaken too late. But we are all dead men on leave, as Eugene Levinet said at his trial in Munich for being a revolutionary after the counter-revolution of 1919. There are still those, often in India for some reason, who make a living claiming land rents from the deceased. From Gogol to Google, if one now looks up the sodality of those who've lived to read of their own demise, one strikes across the relatively good cheer of Mark Twain, who famously declared the report to be an exaggeration, to Ernest Hemingway, whose biographer tells us that he read the obituaries every morning with a glass of champagne. Eventually wearing out the cheery novelty of this and unshipping his shotgun, to the black nationalist Marcus Garvey, who, according to some reports, was felled by a stroke while reading his own death notice.
That was Hitch 22 by Christopher Hitchens.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Cloud Atlas is David Mitchell's work of mind-bending imagination and scope. Perhaps you've seen the new movie and want to go deeper. Or you may be searching for a gift for film enthusiasts. The novel consists of 6 nested stories that take the reader from the remote South Pacific in the 19th century to a distant post-apocalyptic future. Each tale is revealed to be a story that is read by the main character in the next. A reluctant voyager crossing the Pacific in 1850. A disinherited composer cobbling together a precarious livelihood in between the wars in Belgium. A high-minded journalist in Governor Reagan's California. A vanity publisher fleeing the gang. A genetically modified clone on death row. And a young Pacific Islander witnessing the nightfall of science and civilization. The characters of Cloud Atlas hear each other's echoes down the corridor of history, and their destinies are changed in ways great and small. David Mitchell erases the boundaries of language, genre, and time to offer a meditation on humanity's dangerous will to power and where it may lead us. The work is performed by an ensemble cast.
Friday, the 8th of November. In the rude shipyard beneath my window, work progresses on the jib boom under Mr. Sykes's directorship. Mr. Walker, Ocean Bay's sole taverner, is also its principal timber merchant, and he brags of his years as a master shipbuilder in Liverpool. I am now versed enough in Antipodes etiquette to let such unlikely truths lie. Mr. Sykes told me an entire week is needed to render the prophetess Bristol fashion. 7 days holed up in the musket seems a grim sentence, yet I recall the fangs of the banshee tempest and the mariners lost overboard, and my present misfortune feels less acute. I met Dr. Goose on the stairs this morning, and we took breakfast together. He has lodged at the musket since middle October after voyaging hither on a Brazilian merchantman, Namorados, from Fiji, where he practiced his arts in a mission. Now the doctor awaits a long-overdue Australian sealer, the Nelly, to convey him to Sydney. From the colony, he will seek a position aboard a passenger ship for his native London. My judgment of Dr. Goose was unjust and premature. One must be cynical as Diogenes to prosper in my profession, but cynicism can blind one to subtler virtues. The doctor has his eccentricities and recounts them gladly for a dram of Portuguese pisco, never to excess. But I vouchsafe he is the only other gentleman on this latitude east of Sydney and west of Valparaiso. I may even compose for him a letter of introduction for the Partridges in Sydney, for Dr. Goose and dear Fred are of the same cloth. Poor weather precluding my morning outing, we yarned by the peat fire, and the hours sped by like minutes. I spoke at length of Tilda and Jackson, and also my fears of gold fever in San Francisco. Our conversation then voyaged from my hometown to my recent notarial duties in New South Wales, thence to Gibbon, Malthus, and Godwin via leeches and locomotives. Attentive conversation is an emollient I lack sorely aboard the prophetess, and the doctor is a veritable polymath. Moreover, he possesses a handsome army of scrim-shandered chessmen, whom we shall keep busy until either the prophetess's departure or the Nelly's arrival. Saturday, the 9th of November. Sunrise, bright as a silver dollar. Our schooner still looks a woeful picture out in the bay. An Indian war canoe is being careened on the shore. Henry and I struck out for Banqueter's Beach in holiday mood, blithely saluting the maid who labors for Mr. Walker. The sullen miss was hanging laundry on a shrub and ignored us. She has a tinge of black blood, and I fancy her mother is not far removed from the jungle breed. As we passed below the Indian hamlet, a humming aroused our curiosity, and we resolved to locate its source. The settlement is circumvallated by a stake fence, so decayed that one may gain ingress at a dozen places. A hairless bitch raised her head, but she was toothless and dying and did not bark. An outer ring of ponga huts, fashioned from branches, earthen walls, and matted ceilings, groveled in the lees of grandee dwellings, wooden structures with carved lintel pieces and rudimentary porches. In the hub of this village, a public flogging was underway. Henry and I were the only two whites present, but three castes of spectating Indians were demarked. The chieftain occupied his throne in a feathered cloak, while the tattooed gentry and their womenfolk and children stood in attendance, numbering some 30 in total. The slaves, duskier and sootier than their nut-brown masters and less than half their number, squatted in the mud.
We've just heard Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Wanderlust. Whether you're a kid after college or a boomer approaching the end of your official career, escape is a very welcome and frequent daydream. So, Tune in Tokyo by Tim Anderson is a great gift for those who want to take off. So few people actually have the bravery to run away from everything and selflessly seek out personal fulfillment on the other side of the world. Tim Anderson was pushing 30 and working a string of dead-end jobs when he made the spontaneous decision to pack his bags and move to Japan. It was a gutsy move, especially for a tall, white, gay southerner who didn't speak a lick of Japanese. But his life desperately needed a shot of adrenaline, and what better way to get one than to move to, and I quote, a tiny, overcrowded island heaving with clever, sensibly proportioned people who made him look fat, unquote. Tim became an outsider whose stumbling progression through Japanese culture is minutely chronicled in his entertaining new book. Despite the steep learning curve and the seemingly constant humiliation, Tim gradually begins to find his way. And he comes to realize that living a meaningful life is about expecting the unexpected, right when he least expects it. McLeod Andrews narrates.
My spacecraft glides over the Shinjuku district of eastern Tokyo as I swivel giddily in my captain's chair with all the blinking, labelless buttons on the left armrest. Looking out the window, which circles the entire ship, I see the blinking lights, sleek skyscrapers, packed commuter trains, and tiny inhabitants hustling and bustling along sidewalks, across bridges, and into and out of the giant beating heart of Shinjuku Station. My craft touches down slowly and alights on top of the Takashimaya Times Square building, which looks like a giant luxury cruise liner. I rise from my seat, remove my goggles, and prepare myself to be beamed directly into the thick of the madness spread out below me. I set the transporter to Tower Records, Shinjuku, and seconds later, here I am. Actually, no, I take a plane and then a train and then walk for a bit and then sleep for 17 hours and then start work and finally get a day off after 2 weeks. The giant Tower Records television screen just outside the south end of Shinjuku Station plays a pop video featuring a gaggle of preteen girls dressed in shiny, frilly outfits so bright and cutesy they make American child beauty pageant contestants look like Dickensian street urchins. They dance in formation, not particularly well, and stare at the camera, doe-eyed and hollow. I stand at the bottom of a massive escalator looking up at the dangerous display of chiffon and taffeta and excitedly contemplate the pastel-tinted nightmares I will have about all this later. I'm wandering around the city for the first time, enjoying my first day off. I interviewed with a popular language school called MOBA, MOBA, before coming, and they assured me they could place me in Tokyo. An empty promise, it turns out, since I've ended up with an apartment in a town called Fujisawa, an hour south of Tokyo, and a job at a school in nearby Yokohama. A disappointment, yes, like a young small-town Russian with stars in his eyes must feel when he has his heart set on living in the Big Apple and instead is forced to rent a studio in New Brunswick, New Jersey. But I'll make it to Tokyo, no problem. All I need is thousands and thousands of dollars so I can afford to put a deposit and key money down on a fashionable closet or cubbyhole in, say, trendy Shibuya, or perhaps the East Village-like districts of Kichijoji or Koenji. It'll happen. I'll just need to teach a few hundred more English lessons, sell my used diabetes syringes and Piazzadora records on eBay, and limber up for those lap dances. I'll be there in no time. In the meanwhile, I'll continue my job in Yokohama, where I'm honing my communication skills and preparing myself for a career in front of the camera in ways I never anticipated. I have taught so many lessons that I've begun dropping all articles, prepositions, and sometimes the verb to be from my speech just to be more easily understood. On weekend, went to movie and ate nice restaurant. Food so delicious. I've also started pointing to my ears when I talk about listening to music, behind me when talking about the past, and in front of me and over a little hill when talking about the future. Even when talking to my two Australian roommates, Ewan and Sean. MOBA is a popular language school with branches all across Japan. I'd had to fly to Boston for the interview, and though I usually choke during interviews, this one ended, amazingly, with an immediate job offer. Admittedly, it's satisfying to know that simply by virtue of being born in the right place, I have a skill very much in demand in another part of the world. I never really considered my English degree very marketable, and neither has anyone else. College papers touting Jane Austen as England's best Harlequin romance novelist or exploring the homoeroticism in Bleak House won't get you very far in the real world, let's face it. But when I decided to travel to a faraway land of people who want to know how to speak like me, I automatically had a highly marketable skill. I speak great English. Jim, the interviewer and a former MOBA teacher, was clearly dazzled. In fact, he'd seemed to have only one concern.
We've just heard Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell.
It'll be a long haul through the holiday shopping season. If I may, I'd be pleased to be your literary guide for selecting just the right titles for friends and family. My website, bookreportradio.com, can be a great resource for you too. Consult it for ideas. Thanks so much for tuning in, and see you next week on The Book Report.